Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Getting undressed in front of your partner can be really hard. And for Jameson Rich, it was even more complicated. He writes about it in his piece, The Shirt Stays On. It's read by Finn Wittrock, who's been nominated for 2 Emmy Awards and is starring now in the movie Right When You Get Work.
"Aren't you going to take your clothes off?" she asked, her fingers pulling at the edges of my T-shirt. It wasn't sexy the way she said it. No wry smile or soft coo came with the words, just frustration. The ceiling lights were off, but I knew the narrow light spilling from the lamp on my bureau would be enough for her to see the pale red marks on my chest, which had been fading for so long that they had gone back to being shiny again. No one had ever put that question to me so directly. When it came to keeping my shirt on, I'd always gotten away with playing dumb or chalking it up to the hastiness of passion. "I have scars," I managed to say, as bluntly as I could. I was born with a rare heart defect, for which there is no cure, only a series of stop gaps and half measures. I had undergone 4 full open-heart operations by the time I was 15, as well as dozens of less invasive procedures. I'm 23 now, and I'm on my 4th pacemaker. I've spent nearly 20,000 hours of my young life inside hospital walls. For many years, I was not healthy enough to live out of the hospital for more than a few weeks at a time. These surgeries have left many scars. One cuts across my right clavicle on a diagonal, the entry for my 2nd pacemaker at age 12, after the battery for my 1st died so abruptly that my mother received a voicemail message while in the car that said, "You need to come in. Jameson's device is in end-of-life mode." 2 more scars run horizontally across my midsection. The one on the left was carved so recklessly that it created a pocket with a pouch of skin above. Then there is the main attraction, a foot-long line that stretches from between my clavicles to just a few inches above my belly button. This one has been carved up so many times by surgical tools rolling over it again and again like a pizza cutter that different sections have taken on different colors, textures, and thicknesses. The bottom part is bright red, bumpy and ugly. The top third is a straighter line and, having not been disturbed in years, paler than the rest. Before long, I'll be able to wear a V-neck without it being spotted. But this wasn't all. There were the stretch marks, too, caused by the way my abdomen ballooned with undigested liquids, a kind of beer belly driven by heart failure, that were emptied each day via diuretics and regular fluid taps. And there was the divot just above my right hip, a black cavern the size of my finger from when I had a tube to empty my stomach of waste. "This will close up in about a month," the nurse said the day it was removed. It didn't. "It might take a few months. Still nothing. It will close by itself eventually." It never did. When unattached and left to its natural self, the tube hung down to my waistline and pulled painfully on the skin from where it came. So every morning I packaged it up in an elaborate construction of gauze and tape to keep it secured to my skin. I had the tube during my freshman year of college, when I met the first girl I ever kissed, who then became the first girl I ever hooked up with on a consistent basis, but never without the shirt. My first kiss was a dare. I was sitting with friends on the carpeted floor of a dorm room. We had been drinking beer and Smirnoff ice, and my head was swirling. My weak liver and broken heart couldn't process and redistribute blood and body fluid correctly, meaning they sure as hell couldn't process alcohol efficiently. I barely blinked when someone in the room suggested a game of truth or dare, knowing that when my turn came, I would pick truth, as always. But it never got to that. Becky chose a girl, and that girl chose dare. And soon Becky's finger was scanning the room like radar, commanding, "I dare you to kiss." Her movement slowed, lingering on people as her finger passed. The girl winced as Becky's finger finally stopped on me, and then she shrugged. I said nothing, planted against the dresser behind me. I thought about mentioning that this kiss, at age 18, would be my first, but I knew announcing that would be worse than just letting it happen. She crawled over and fell forward, almost starting the kiss before she even landed. Her lips closed around mine like parentheses, touching but not connecting. We would spend the next few weeks convening in stairwells, hiding under covers, sneaking around and keeping our secret from friends, all while rarely talking, mostly touching, never connecting. When it ended, both of us sitting on the lip of the fountain in Washington Square Park, staring straight ahead, I wouldn't admit to myself that the feeling in the pit of my stomach was one of relief. Relief that it didn't get far enough to have to show her everything. She saw about 10%, and that was plenty. She never saw the scars, and she knew even less about what they meant. It has taken time, nearly all of my 23 years, for me to learn how much to say, whom to tell, what to show of myself. I have learned exactly how much people care to know, and what they care to know, and how much it matters to them. Whenever I first tell people about my diagnosis, I usually get a flurry of questions and then they catch themselves and say, "I hope you don't mind me asking questions. We don't have to talk about it if you don't want to." "That's okay," I say. "We'll talk about it until you don't want to." It's not that people lose interest. There just always comes a point when we need to move on and talk normally about normal things so the balance of our conversation can even out. But something about my scars feels more precious. All through childhood, I carried a bit of extra weight, mostly in my stomach. And every year when summer rolled around, I'd find ways to keep my shirt on in the hot sun at the beach or the pool or on vacation or at parties. I told my parents it was because of the scars, because I was actually embarrassed by the weight, and then later told them it was because of the weight, because I was actually embarrassed by the scars. The thing about the physical side is that I can talk all I want about what I've been through, what it felt like to grow up with chronic illness and to know nothing else, with the science and the diagnoses and the dates and everything that can be measured. But the faded cuts and holes and lines that speckle my body are the closest I can get to proof. Eventually, scars will fade, but you can't uncut skin. And I've earned them. So maybe a part of me believes that seeing them is something you need to earn. I'll show you when I know they'll matter to you. I'll show you when I want you to see all my scars, both above and below the surface. I have never been in love. I have been in like. I have loved people, but I've never been in mutual love. I have never even been in a relationship, never called someone mine and had them call me theirs. I've never found someone who cares enough to hold my hand in waiting rooms or to hear about the worst parts of everything, about all the firsts I never got to experience or what I remembered of flatlining. But, like many people in their 20s, I have found myself in beds wrapped around people I don't know very well, sharing our bodies before we have shared much else. So, while I'm still figuring it all out, I sometimes have to improvise. Like with the girl who acted frustrated about my not taking off my shirt. I met her on Tinder. She was in the city for only a month, visiting New York on break from college. We talked for a few days online before meeting for drinks and ultimately ending up back at my apartment. After making out for 20 minutes, she pulled away and looked up at me in the dim light coming from the corner of my bedroom. And that's when she said it. "Aren't you going to take your clothes off?" I knew she would be able to see more than I was ready to show. I have scars. So?
That's Finn Wittrock reading Jameson Rich's essay, "The Shirt Stays On." We'll catch up with Jameson after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Jameson Rich says that when his piece came out 2 years ago, he thought his major health challenges were behind him. But about 6 months later, something unexpected happened.
I was standing in my apartment one night and I felt a really fast heartbeat come on out of nowhere. And I put my fingers to my wrist and to my neck, as I've learned to do my whole life, to check my pulse, and I didn't feel anything back. And after about a minute, it wasn't going away. And so I called 911. They put me up on the monitor and the machine thought my heart rate was going around 200 beats per minute. But in truth, my heart wasn't really beating at all. I was in an episode of sustained ventricular tachycardia. It's called VTAC. So they put the paddles on me and I felt probably the most intense pain I've ever felt in my life and was literally picked up off the gurney and set back down by the force of the charge.
The incident made Jameson think differently about the time he has.
All that really mattered to me was if I had people to call in that moment. So I've made sure to not let my relationships and my personal life fall to the side, because really what matters at the end of the day, what it comes down to, what you care about in that moment is, you know, who is in your life.
At that time, Jameson was dating a woman who also had a heart condition and who had reached out to him after reading his Modern Love piece. That relationship didn't last, but it helped him learn to be vulnerable, something that's been important as he's entered a new relationship.
I'm with someone now who has not been through it personally, but is so incredibly understanding and has made me comfortable with my scars and everything in a way that I never have been, because my instinct with someone who hasn't gone through it is still to hide a little bit, and the trust and the patience and the love is so strong and obvious that I don't need to hide.
Jameson's health is better now, though his prognosis is uncertain.
I think when I was born, like, a good prognosis was to live into the 20s. I know that's not the case anymore. These surgeries that are done to us when we're really young, the total effects are not known until a long time down the road. So I'm generally very healthy, but there is a wild card aspect to it.
And when Jameson talks to people who've read his essay, they often seem worried about him.
They get this kind of very concerned look, and they want to know how I'm doing, and not about the health stuff, but just, you know, with the relationship stuff. And the answer is I'm great. In general, I want people to try to operate with less fear, which is a thing that I'm trying to do every day. The best stuff happens when you operate in your day-to-day with a healthy amount of openness.
That's Jameson Rich. He lives in New York City, where he works in film production and is currently at work on a memoir. We've got more after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Here's Modern Love editor Daniel Jones.
He was really able to capture what it's like to not only have to navigate sex and relationships and physical contact, which is awkward enough in college and your early 20s, but to have that compounded by having this chest that, as he describes it, was sort of cut up as though he were cut up by a pizza cutter. It's a different kind of virginity in a way, you know, to take his shirt off as it is to have sex or whatever else. His is an extreme situation, but everybody's got something. And it's such a common experience to sort of feel just embarrassment and fear of being so early in a relationship to have to deal with something, in his case, that's so weighty.
And here's Finn Wittrock.
It was a point of view that I'd never really heard before, and the kind of vulnerability that he expresses was very touching to me. I remember being 23 and awkward and always feeling like you're needing to be more vulnerable than you're ready to be. And I can only imagine that this guy's got to be like 10 times more vulnerable than that. So I was just really intrigued by the clarity that he has about his own feelings.
Thanks again to Finn for reading this week's piece. His new movie is Right When You Get Work. Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, and John Parati. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. If you love the show, leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners find us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.